let's flip the album over, and the top photo is a band playing live, and the lower photo is the band playing live and being recorded, apparently on a reel-to-reel tape. What's the story behind those two photos?
Those pictures were taken at Mr. Lucky's. I could tell you who some of these people are that were in the picture, too. And they were recording a live album at Mr. Lucky's.
Yeah, who was doing the recording?
That was K-Bank.
Well, it's K-Bank. Do you know who the engineers are?
I would suspect that one of them had to be Tom Jung, probably, and John.
I'm not sure Tom was there that Sunday. It was a Sunday afternoon at Mr. Lucky's. The result, they didn't like what they recorded there.
No.
They never used it. I kind of think the volume was more than what they could handle on the fly. It wasn't in the studio, and I kind of think the technicalities kind of threw them.
Okay.
Mike, at some point you start recording the band live, correct?
Well, I'm watching all this. I was down there. I was at Jim Thaxter's living room, and my stepmother happened to have a reel-to-reel recorder that was portable, and I would go down to K-Bank and watch when they recorded the album, any of the singles, and all this was starting to come together, you know. That's how it's done, huh?
Yeah.
How George operated on his end.
What kind of machine did you have, Mike?
Oh, it was Revere was the one I was borrowing that I first took to a dance they played. This is a lot later after the album hit.
Okay.
To a club in outside of the Dells, Wisconsin Dells. They played quite a bit at a club by the name of XX. I can't think of it. That burned down since.
XX?
No, that stands for can't remember.
You're not talking about the Roof Gardens. That was in Iowa.
No, this was Wisconsin Dells near there.
Woodbridge Country Dam?
No, that's Amory. We can look it up, whatever.
But
Larry Rieger and I made a trip down that Friday night or Saturday, I think we recorded. There, they said, you can record. We've never heard ourselves play live, you know, other than being there listening at the time. Go ahead and record it. We'd like to hear what we sound like. So I believe we took it back to the motel that night, and they got to hear, you know, their live gig.
Did you have one mic or two?
At that point, one.
One mic.
Off of one of the, off the PA, not even off the PA, in front of someplace where the sound was,
That's
coming
interesting.
Together.
So you get back to the hotel, and now you get to listen to what the band sounds like. What do you think?
Oh, boy. We never took ourselves that seriously. You know, we still don't. We just were amazed that people wanted to come out and listen to us play. And to this day, I don't ever like listening to myself.
Really?
No, not at all. I've got a lot of things that I've recorded. Even TV shows that we did, I don't watch it. We did, national TV shows. I don't want to watch it.
Speaking of TV shows, there's a video of Steve Warr on American Bandstand, doing a dance to Surfin' Bird.
I remember watching it. I was sick. I had a fever when I watched that, laying on a couch.
And
watching
how was it just Steve wound up out there?
They couldn't afford the whole band. And we said, you know, go out there and do it. And Steve didn't want to go without the band. And he still didn't want to go. And I think with a number of phone calls, they couldn't afford the whole band, so he went out and did it.
Okay.
And it was not a good experience for him. He didn't like any part of it.
Really?
No.
Okay. All right, so 45 number 2 comes out, and that's Bird Dance Beat, backed with A-Bone.
Yeah.
And any story behind those two songs?
We didn't know about making money writing songs. George Garrett decided that he'd write a song, and this is the song that you're going to do on the second record. And so we did it. Actually, it made the national charts, you know. And A-Bone is another song that Larry wrote. Mm-hmm. It came out, and it really started taking off. But the Beatles came into play. This thing was with a bullet was coming up, and the Beatles were discovered, and it was the end of American music as we knew it. Mm. You know,
February 64.
Yeah.
Was the Beatles' appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Right.
So you could actually see the impact.
Yeah, and not only that, but we were playing in New York City. We had a show we were playing, and I think it was something with Frankie Avalon, if I remember, and Terry Stafford, you know, who had Suspicion, and, you know, these songs. And Ringo Starr was asked about how he, if he liked Surfing Bird, and he came out and said he didn't like the Trashmen.
Really?
Yeah, and so... that didn't have a real good taste in our mouth at the time, and we couldn't figure out why we didn't. I remember Dal turning around and saying, "So what's the matter with me?" You know.
All right, and that brings us to 45 number 3, which is Bad News and On the Move. What's the story with those two songs?
We were searching for anything to try to get a record, you know, to take off like that again. They wanted to stick with that same, they being Garrett and Heilecker, wanted to stick with that same kind of stuff, you know. So we did, and it did make the national charts, you know, with the Beatles and English music on the rise, with all these other groups coming out. Is
that a cover song?
Bad News, Church Key.
That's a standard.
Church Key was an instrumental recorded. I think people like Link Wray recorded it, and some other groups back then. What does it say?
It says Church Key and On the Move.
Yeah.
Is there...
On the Move, I actually wrote that. I don't know whose name is on there, but I actually wrote it. It's just one of the things. We needed a filler song for the other side, and just wrote that song.
It's an instrumental.
Yeah, it's an instrumental song.
Okay, and the next 45 is a song called Peppermint Man on the A side and New Generation on the B side.
Right. Peppermint Man was a Dick Dale song that we did. It had just recorded it, and they wanted to release it. We didn't really want to release it, but they decided to release it. And that also made the national charts, but didn't do what we wanted it to do. The British invasion was underway.
And New Generation was written by?
Tony Khairy.
Tony wrote that?
Yeah. And there's, in New Generation, I think there's a big explosion in it that we didn't want. We didn't have any artistic control at all, you know, with our stuff. George Garrett thought this would be really cool to have that explosion in it. Because it said like an atom bomb and boom and the explosion went off. Well, there's no reason to have that in there, but they did it. You know, it's kind of a neat song, really. You know, when we were doing that, there was really very little rehearsal, if any, and it just came in. And here's a song that Tony recorded, that wrote, and we did it. We just come in and do it. They wanted it done now, you know. And we were out doing 292 one-nighters that year, so.
Who's booking the band at this time?
Jimmy Thomas out of Laverne, Minnesota, was booking the band. It's the only reason, Jimmy's the only reason we made money, is because we always had a handshake contract with him. That's it. If he did well, we did well. And so we started with him booking all the armories and all the auditoriums around the country ourselves. Jimmy would travel with us. He'd take the door along with his son, would come along with us too. And they would count the door. And we'd split the money. And so I remember we went into Duluth, and bands were making $200, $150 to $250 bucks a night for the band, you know, and we took out $2,700 in a night. Well, you could buy a brand new car for that.
Because you got a percentage of the door.
Yeah, right. And coming back here, the clubs wanted to pay us the same that we were being paid before. You know, the prom would pay us union scale. It was $89, I think, for the band. Mm-hmm. So then Dick Clay decided that, you know, we can make a lot of money. We'll give them a door deal. We'll try it once. And so they made money and we made money. They doubled the door price. And so they made some good money and we did too. And so after that, most of our deals were door deals. And so we hired a guy to go on the road with us to count the door for us. And that was Tim Rayberger, and he came on the road with us for 3 years, I think.
Did you play the Marigold Ballroom?
Sure. Yeah. All the ballrooms around here we played, all over the country. When you say 292 one-nighters in a year, that's a lot of one-nighters.
That'd be 64 then?
64.
Wow.
And 65 was over 270 one-nighters. Mm. So we did that until 1967. We were playing, even in our last year, it was way over 200 dates.
Wow.
And so we decided we're not doing this anymore. Music changed. It was, acid rock was starting.
Okay.
You know, didn't want to do it. Music had changed. Kids weren't dancing anymore.
Okay, so after Peppermint Man and New Generation, your next 45 is Whoa Dad and Walking My Baby.
Right.
What's the story with those two songs?
Different sound. Wanted to get away from the surf stuff. And just do something that would be nice. And Walking My Baby was an original song. That it was a nice song. We think that's probably the best song we recorded.
Really? And yeah. Whoa Dad is original?
Who Let me that? Jump in there. They were looking for material. And George, supposedly, I believe, went to Nashville looking yeah. for material to Acuff Rose Publishing. And they had Felice and Boudlow Bryant as staff writers or worked with Acuff Rose. Those two songs were written by Felice and Boudlow, famous writers in the country genre. Lots of hits from them. Yeah, they. Mm. I guess for some reason George got these two presented to him and he brought them back and they did them.
And how about Dancing with Santa and Real Live Doll?
Dancing with Santa, Larry Leopold did write that.
Okay.
Just, they wanted to release a Christmas record. And you know, I still hear that played on Christmas time. I mean, even KSDP was playing it when they were still playing music, and WCCO. I would hear it usually on the Boone and Erickson show in the morning at Christmas time. They would always play Dancing with Santa.
Okay.
It was done as a last-minute project when somebody decided, let's go for a Christmas song. Real Live Doll was written by Steve. That was his contribution. He actually wrote it, no question about it.
So your next 45 is on the Bear label, and it's Keep Your Hands Off My Baby, which I believe was a Carole King song with Jerry Goffin, the songwriter. And the flip side, Lost Angel. How did you end up on the Bear label? Whose label was that?
There was a company in town that was, his name was, it was Lieberman.
Lieberman Distributing,
yeah.
Similar to Heilitzer Brothers.
Okay. Yeah. And they had the Bear label. I don't know how they came up with it.
George probably was the connection there.
Probably.
Don't you think?
Yeah.
He worked, they were after George, maybe they came, approached him, let us try distributing one of the Trashman songs, records, I suspect.
Yeah, and anyway, it was released. It did really well in Canada and in Europe and different places. We never knew about it, however, but it was, it's a song that we had fun doing, you know, it was a, I sang it, it was a high falsetto voice. It was a different kind of voice again with rock background voices. And it worked well live.
It charted well in Canada, I believe.
Yeah.
Really high.
Yeah.
Because you guys did a tour after that, I believe, mm-hmm. up there.
Yeah. And Lost Angel is another Larry Leopold song, apparently.
Yeah.
It's one he had from his earlier catalog that, a ballad.
And it looks like you are on the Argo label with Bird 65 and Ubangi Stomp. What is the story with these two songs?
Gosh, you tell me. I don't know. It was just another Bird song. It was 1965, you know, and the Bird, we thought maybe it would take off again. I don't know if that was our idea or whose idea it was. Ubangi Stomp was just a song that we were doing at the time on stage.
Was that a cover song?
It was a cover song that Jerry Lee Lewis had recorded, I think, back on Sun. Now, when we have these, you know, the shows we're doing today, we still do that song. was a fun song to do.
And Bird 65, the writers are listed as White, Wilson, Harris, and Fraser.
Those are the people that got the credit for the Surfing Bird also.
Oh, these are the guys from the Rivingtons?
Right.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
And then that brings us to the Tribe 45. The A side is Same Lines, and the B side is Hanging on Me. Any story with the Tribe 45?
Huey Moe in Houston, Texas, was a guy that Jimmy Thomas knew. He had a couple hits under his belt that year. He basically went down there and tried to make something happen. We recorded Hanging on Me and Same Lines. Actually, I've had people tell me that that's their favorite song that we ever did.
Which one?
Same Lines. I have no clue as to why they would say that, but they do. And I wrote that song, I think, in Wisconsin one day, and it was kind of a Bob Dylan kind of thing. And Same Lines, along with Hanging on Me, was what they released. Actually, that made the Bubbling Under on Billboard also, believe it or not. At that point. But we were starting to think about something else, you know, when this happened.
Okay.
Started doing something else.
Other than
playing music.
Really?
Yeah. We were thinking about it because we were playing a lot, but we didn't want to do this. It wasn't going in the right direction. So we didn't want to end up playing clubs and things, you know. So I think about that time when Green Green Backs came out, we thought about maybe doing something else. And so Green Green Backs was a lot of fun to do. We had some friends on there playing with us, you know. I think it was just a takeoff on Green Green Grass at Home with a Gabby Hayes kind of voice. And that got played actually on the Ralph Emery Show on WSM. It got actually some airplay because it was so unusual.
And the flip side of that is called Address Enclosed. And
just a country song.
That's one of Larry's songs?
Yeah, just a country song that I sang with a girl I was dating at the time.
And the backside actually lists the artists as Tony Jones and Nancy Montgomery.
It's just a takeoff on George Jones and Melba Montgomery.
Cover up the real people.
People,
yeah.
Because
he was a little shy then. Shy, yeah. Yeah. That was 1967.
Yeah.
It evolved from, they were playing the Gables Club. Had a regular job there, a regular gig for months, yeah. I believe.
Not months, but we played there like weekends. We'd play there. We probably did it weekends probably, you know, 6 or 8 times. And that's when we really decided to hang it up.
And what was the reason you decided to hang it up?
Music wasn't going in a direction we wanted to go, and there were other things we wanted to do. We had a run, and it was fun, and we played a couple thousand dates. We decided that we were going to do something else, and so Bob went to work. He had a family. He went to work for a manufacturing company. I was doing sessions for about 6 months. I didn't do anything but say I did a lot of sessions with Herb Pilhofer and people like that. I decided that I wanted to do something else, and so I decided I'd become a police officer, and was hired actually by the Minneapolis Police Department. And at the same time I had met an attorney. His name was Tom McCoy, and he introduced me to the financial planning business, insurance business that I was in for 44 years.
I'm kind of curious, being on the road, what would a typical day be like for the Trashmen playing on the road?
Well, traveling. We had anywhere from, you know, 150 to 500 miles a day that we would
travel. Did you have a bus, or how did you get around?
We had a van for a while. We thought about a bus for a while. We decided the only way to go to really get the sleep you need and so forth is to buy the biggest station wagon you can find and get a really good trailer and put it on the back with real heavy suspension and really big tires and really big wheels. Travel in comfort, you know, and that's what we did.
So you could sleep in the back of the...
Well, we could, but we stayed in specifically in Holiday Inns and mostly Howard Johnson's every night. So we slept in a good place every night, and we had it timed where we knew how long it would take us to go someplace. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we'd travel all night long and get into a town at 6-7 in the morning. They knew we were coming, and we'd sleep until the gig that night, and then maybe sleep again that night if we had a short distance to go the next day, and travel and find good places for food. You know, the partying and everything that people hear about back then didn't happen very often, mm-hmm. you know, because you were playing so many dates, and you found out really quickly that if you were doing a lot of that, you just were didn't feel good enough. You didn't. So we had it down to if we had a day or two off, yeah, we'd have fun. We'd be traveling to Phoenix, Arizona or someplace. We had a couple of days off. We'd get a really nice place at a really nice hotel with a really nice pool and just hang out for 2 days. And, you know, charge up our batteries. So our typical day was traveling, getting to the gig, finding out where it is, setting up, and finding out where we're going to stay, getting dressed, play the show, go back to the motel, sleep, get up the next day, look for the coffee pot, get in the rig, and off we go.
This is before GPS and Google and cell phones. No cell phones mm-hmm. to call the venue and find out where they're located.
We did this in Europe. We call it the Freddy Tour a year ago. We had 23 dates. We played 11 days straight one day in different towns. Berlin, Germany, Rostock, Germany. And we played all these places. And we did that at our advanced ages, you know, being geriatric rockers now. It was tiring, but we did it, and gosh, some of the venues were just spectacular to be able to do that again, and we were pretty tired at the end of it. But on the plane coming back, I looked at Dal and I said, you know, now that it's all said and done, and it's over, and here we are going back, would you do it again? And he looked and he says, in a heartbeat, we'd do it again. Yeah. Who would have ever thought that we'd be doing it now? So it basically was the same now as it was then, only we're in a nicer van. I mean, it was a Mercedes, a big Mercedes van. We had our own seats and all that. It was a little more plush.
So when you went into these towns,
yeah,
all across the country, were you treated like rock stars by the kids?
Oh, sure. We were.
They knew Surfenberg.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Sure.
They would yell for it. And
yeah, there wasn't the... I think there wasn't that godlike kind of thing back then. I mean, you were rock and roll guitar players, mm-hmm. and girls wanted to take pictures with you, and they wanted to meet with you and so forth. We were very careful about getting in the trouble of any kind. We didn't want it. We knew a lot of bands that didn't want any part of it, didn't have the time. There are lots of funny stories, I mean, like that, about being in hotel rooms. I mean, funny stories. There were girls that were missing one night when we played a show, and they were oogling us, and somebody saw them with us at the end of the deal by our van, you know, and we were on our way, didn't know where these girls went. Well, somebody contacted the police. The police came to the Howard Johnson's where we were staying with the manager, with a key, burst into the room. And Steve had long blonde hair, and his hair he was in bed. We were all asleep, and they burst into this room, and the guy yelled, "There she is!" And Steve said, he went and sat up in bed, "What's going on?" You know, had no clue as to where these girls were. But there were funny things like that happened, but it was mostly just going. We were in places. You know, we read stories about us going into a restaurant when we were touring, and somebody put on Surfin' Bird on the jukebox because we were there, and somebody else, some guy, turned it off and pulled the plug on it, and we got so irate that we ran out of there and never paid our bill. And we were never in the place. We had no clue as to where this place was or, you know, who these people were. So I keep things like that. I've got articles like that never happened. You know, we read lots of stories like that about us that never happened.
Huh.
No.